patients, and I position myself right in the middle. Now, let's see, I'll start with, well, part of the generation clash has been, I think, that not everyone may know who these people are. Some American posters will think that quantum mechanics was invented by Feynman. But this is Bohr. And this is one of his most famous phrases. He wrote this in honor of Einstein in the Einstein Festschrift, philosopher scientist, on the occasion of his 70th birthday. And I took it because with the other quotation, it sort of summarizes what for me is the essence of the Copenhagen interpretation. So Bohr says, however far the phenomena transcend the scope of classical physical explanation, the account of all evidence must be expressed in classical terms. And the emphasis here is not on experiments, or the idea that physics is operational and that everything has to be understood in terms of experiments. Neither is the emphasis on the size of the system or on the macroscopic nature of the apparatus. It's exclusively in terms of the classical description. And if you look at it from that point of view, nothing will stop you from, in fact, doing quantum cosmology from a Copenhagen point of view. So as long as you put the necessity of a classical description at the front, instead of all talks about operationalism or experiments, you're still in the context of the Copenhagen interpretation. And it's much more flexible than what people actually normally believe this interpretation is. Now, Heisenberg, in a sort of less well-known quotation, adds to this that the entire source or origin of the uncertainties of quantum mechanics, for which he means both his own, say, uncertainty relations, and also the general probabilistic nature of measurement outcomes, these uncertainties have their whole origin in the classical description. So if you were only to look at the quantum world without any observers or eyeguesses, there would be no probability in quantum mechanics. And this is a subtle situation that is not captured by saying that probabilities are subjective, as the Bayesians try to teach us. I noticed that in quantum information theory, this may also be part of the generation clash, that physicists are called agents, and probabilities are betting quotients, related to gambling. It's certainly a gamble to have a post or career, so I understand these people saying this, but the situation with quantum uncertainty and probability is subtle, isn't it? The probabilities are neither subjective nor objective in the usual sense. Since the objective nature would be the quantum world in which there are no probabilities according to the Copenhagen interpretation. But once you identify a classical stratum, or an experiment, if you like, in a classical description, then due to this coarse graining, you get a probabilistic description, which is still is largely objective in the sense that there is no prior result. I'll return to this point. But the situation is much more subtle than I think most people suggest, and I'm certainly aware of this. So this is from his book, Physics and Philosophy. I think Bohr himself gave rise to many of the misrepresentations of his work. I think his writing is largely obscure and very poorly phrased, but there's still a sort of a red line of consistent ideas. For example, he never says that the world, part of the world, is classical, and that there's an interface between the classical and the quantum. So it's always that you describe the experiment as if it were classical. So I think, at least in his earlier life, Bohr would certainly agree that the quantum world is fundamental. Later, he came to deny the existence of the quantum world, since his philosophy made it somewhat a linguistic term. But at the time of this photograph, I think he was not senile yet, and his thoughts were very sharp. I think Heisenberg remained sharp until the very end. So for me, this is what captures the Copenhagen interpretation. And so my program, not just for this talk, but much more generally, is to make sense of this. And explaining the classical world as we see it is part of this program. And so there are a number of things you have to do conceptually. Firstly, you have to identify the classical context or classical strata. I think if you could criticize Bohr and Heisenberg for one thing, is that they, I think, overlooked how difficult it is. They never got beyond making rather vague remarks on the connection being small or the system being large. But if you actually seriously look for a classical description within a quantum system, it is extremely hard. You have to do it in various limiting regimes, and one of those, namely the limit of a large system, is the contact scale, this top. So then, certainly one has to find an explanation of the Born rule, but this is quite a popular game, both in the many worlds interpretation and the Bayesian approaches to quantum physics. And I'd say that also a part of the essence of the Copenhagen view of quantum physics is that measurement outcomes are fundamentally random. So once you have chosen a classical context, nature remains unpredictable within that classical context. Although the fact, the unpredictability and the probabilistic nature is ultimately a consequence of this coarse grading by giving a classical description. Once you have one, it's still unpredictable. And this has to be shown in some way, and I'll say a few things about that. Now, what I want to discuss today, and I wouldn't be able to discuss even if I had time, is two ingredients that would, for me, complete the Copenhagen interpretation, and which you could capture under the phrase of complementarity, but I think you can give this a very technical meaning. Firstly, there's the problem of the coexistence of various classical strata, or classical descriptions. So Bohr was certainly aware of the need of doing that. I think himself made no progress in that at all. What I understood recently, in fact from Hilary Greaves, is that the modern many worlds interpretation is basically the Copenhagen interpretation in a serious way. So people no longer believe that the quantum world splits up in the many worlds interpretation. You still have a single quantum state, but it's the sort of simultaneous existence of various classical strata that forms the essence of the modern many-world interpretation. And in that sense, I support it, and more analysis is necessary to actually make sense of it. The second point is the localization of observables within each classical strata or context. So you have a big algebra that is not commutative, and you look at various, say, commutative sub-algebras, and a given operator may not lie in any of them. That are of interest. So you have to give a localization prescription of a given observable in this context, in that context, in the other context, and these descriptions are related. And a very effective mathematical framework is the topos theoretic framework of category theory. This has become increasingly popular, partly due to the work of Kresausian. But also that, I think, fits into the nature of the Copenhagen interpretation. It's a mathematical method for making sense of simultaneously existing classical contexts whose metaphysics should then be explained by the many worlds interpretation. But fortunately for you, I won't get into this anymore. But that's, I think, where my heart is. Right. Now, the earlier conceptual goals I will translate into technical goals, which are the topic of this talk. Naively, you would say that if you have a large non-commutative algebra that describes a given quantum system, finding a classical context or strata means that you just pick up a commutative sub-algebra. But that's not how it's done. I mean, it's not as easy as that. So what you have to do is, through limiting procedures, actually construct classical algebras or commutative algebras out of a given non-commutative ones. And this I'll show in detail how this can be accomplished. And there are two examples that I think are reasonably well understood. One is the traditional classical limit, in the sense of Planck's constant going to zero, but that fits into this framework. In fact, you can see the commutativity arise when you make Planck's constant small. And that's, I think, mathematically really extremely well understood now through the subject, through the technique of deformation quantization, and especially the C-star algebraic version. The other traditional classical limit is that of a large system. And in this, I would say, is less well understood, and it's one of my goals to explain, because it's basically part of the same mathematical framework as deformation quantization. So if you look at some serious mathematical papers on large systems, they will use a heavy language of Riemann algebras and infinite tensor products. Now, you could argue that already using the word C star, it amounts to using heavy language as well. But it's nothing compared to what people do using von Neumann algebraic constructions and strong limits and so on in the context of the mathematical literature on the large system. So I think that this is wholly unnecessary. There's a very clear, at least to me, clear and transparent description that avoids all this machinery. Some people, I'm sure, at least one, but more people may be familiar with attempts to derive the Born rule, for example, and not as a postulate, but as a theorem of quantum mechanics. And all these attempts, I think, have failed because of mathematical difficulties involving infinite tensor products. And these can be avoided, these problems. And so the fundamental point of this talk, or the claim, is that both limits, h bar to zero and n to infinity, fall under the same mathematical heading, which I will explain as being the theory of continuous fields of C-star algebras. And I repeat the claim, although this sounds heavy, it's in fact very conceptual compared to what has been done earlier. And so I will try to give you what I see as a transparent proof of the Born rule. Whether or not you can derive the Born rule, we can discuss. But my claim is only that the mathematical problems involved in early derivations can be avoided. And also that you can give a proof of randomness to measurement outcomes using this language. So, yes?
Just a background clarification question. If the h bar goes to zero, then I feel fairly comfortable with. The point is you have a single quantum system.
Yes.
And you say that observables like x and p sort of gain the property of being roughly classical. In the second approach, is the idea that the observables of the single system are replaced with macroscopic
observables? Yeah, I'll come to that. Okay. That's the fact. That's the case. You could have asked, that's the question I expected, what h-bar to zero means, given the fact that h-bar is a constant of nature. I think we all know the answer. This is about regimes. You could add the mass of the particle. You could add characteristic length scale of potential for a Schrodinger operator. And you get an effective value of h-bar. That's what goes to zero in the classical regime. So this is the program. Now, also, as part of the generation pledge, I felt a sort of lack of references to earlier work in the earlier talks. And so I would like to explicitly say who my heroes are, at least whose papers I understood, so let's put it that way. So the Copenhagen interpretation is very difficult, and so I tried to read both the original sources and comments on it. And by far the best book I found is not so. It's one that's not well known in England or in the Anglo-Saxon world. It's by a German philosopher physicist called Scheibe. And the book is called The Logical Analysis of Quantum Mechanics. But it's not about quantum logic. It's largely about the Copenhagen interpretation. And this gives really a razor-sharp analysis of what Bohr and Heisenberg meant. Then, secondly, there's a PhD thesis about the philosophy of physics of Heisenberg by someone I've never met called Camille Levy, which I recommend. So that's a book, but it's someone's PhD thesis. It may have to mature yet, but it's very instructive. Then the theory of macroscopic observables. I think the fundamental idea goes back to Bobo-Newwolf that was made in a paper on superfluidity. And then Haar gave this a mathematical twist in a paper on superconductivity, that the essential physical idea is the same in both cases. And there are other very good papers on those lines. So one is by Klaus Hepp. And what specifically motivated me for giving the description I will is a series of papers by Reinhard Werner with two different collaborators. So his some papers with Duffield and some with Raggio, which were published around 1990, and which contain also very heavy machinery. But if you see through it, you get the description that I will present to you, which is, I think, much simpler. But from a certain perspective, all I will do is just put the dots on the I of these papers. That they were unnecessarily complicated, but all the mathematical ideas are there. So Werner is the same person that you know as one of the people in quantum information and quantum computing. Well, quantization theory, you only need to know two papers. One is by Bereisen and one is by Riefel. So Bereisen introduced the idea of deformation quantization, and Riefel made it mathematical. And then the Born rule, well, I should have started with Born, but the tradition of trying to derive the Born rule as a theorem of quantum mechanics, I think, started with Finkelstein, was continued by Hartle, and there are many, many later papers about this. These papers are all worth, still worth reading, although they may not be mathematically accurate, but they're full of ideas. And then I will say a few things about randomness that I don't feel very comfortable with. But the notion of randomness that I will use goes back to Kolmogorov Chaitin and the attempt to derive the randomness of a sequence of measurement outcomes. Using that notion of randomness, I think, was started by Coleman and Lesniewski in a legendary unpublished work. And that has been taken up by a mathematician called Goodman. And what I'll do is, I think, correct the Goodman's proof. Right. So, I'll say a few things about deformation quantization. There's a conceptual part, and there's its mathematical implementation. And the idea is very simple. The idea is that you have a family of quantum theories labeled by Planck's constant. And at the boundary of that family sits classical mechanics, or classical physics. So you can literally visualize the classical limit of quantum mechanics as a fiber bundle, but not a fiber bundle of the type you might be used to. It's a fiber bundle over a base space that in which Planck's constant takes values, and that in any case should include zero, the classical point. And so you have a bundle of theories over it, of which classical physics is the boundary. The fact that there are similar ideas actually in string theory, and more specifically in N theory. And it has sort of spaces of parameters where at certain boundary points interesting things happen. But this is much simpler. And I mean, the execution of this idea, I think, it took so long because you have to look at it from an algebraic point of view. So you might expect that what you have to do is glue a phase space to a family of Hilbert spaces. And in fact, you might be able to do that, but it's much easier to look at it from the observables rather than the state point of view. So what you technically have to do is you have to take functions on phase spaces, the classical observables, rather than phase space itself, and that's glued to operators on Hilbert space as the quantum observables, rather than Hilbert space itself. So that this leads you to the language of operator algebras, which even if you're not interested in quantum field theory or in infinite systems, is a very nice tool for this type of gluing. In fact, I wouldn't know any mathematical language in which you could do it except operator algebras. And so technically, well, what I would say is that classical and quantum algebras observables jointly form what's called the continuous field of C-star algebras. And I'll give the definition of that. Now, there is a key, before giving this definition, I'd like to make the main point, which is that the key difference between a vector bundle that you're familiar with and a continuous field of C-star algebras is that the continuous field of C-star algebras is not necessarily locally trivial, in the sense that the fibers are not necessarily all isomorphic. And of course, that is necessary to have quantum and classical theory in one bundle. And that couldn't happen in the language of vector bundles, where everything is basically the same, and you only have global topology. You have that as well here, but more important than the global topology is, in fact, the freedom of having different fibers in a continuous field. And also, in this language, and that's the nature of operator algebras, it's very easy to do things infinite-dimensionally. And in fact, the type of gluing that is needed to describe the classical limit is, I think, impossible even in 500 dimensions. So this language I came to like more and more, and I'm glad I have the opportunity of advertising it here. So what does this mean? Well, like a vector bundle, you have a base space, and the general concept of the continuous field can be defined over almost any base space. It has to be locally compact or Hausdorff. But in the context of the classical limit of this talk, of large systems, there are only two base spaces that we will need to look at. So one is R, and the other one is slightly more involved. It's the union of 0 plus 1 over each natural number. So if you take a sequence 1 over n that converges to 0, and that's another example of base space. I mean, the fact that it converges to 0 will enable us to study infinite systems by continuity. And there are, for experts in quantization theory, there are examples in quantization theory where h bar is the Rolle variable, where you actually also have a discrete parameter space, notably if you quantize compact phase spaces. You get basically into a situation like this. But if you quantize like a particle moving in Rn, or any system which has a non-compact phase space, You could just say if you take the value space of Planck's constant to be R, and if you don't like it, you could take the positive real axis as long as you include zero. Now, what is a bundle? So it's the course's description is that it's a disjoint union over the base space of C star algebra. So each A of X is a C star algebra, and I don't call X A bar here, because that's not the only application. In quantization theory, in the classical limit, you take H bar. In the theory of large systems, it's the one over the number of particles. So I call this X generically. So we have a family of C star algebras, A of X, indexed by the base space. And in quantization theory, it typically happens that the zeros fiber, A0, is commutative. It's basically functions of classical phase space in quantization theory. In the theory of large systems, as I will explain in detail, there are two different continuous fields that you can study. There may be more, but I'll talk about two instead. So one consists of the macroscopic observables of the system, and then A0 is commutative, as in the classical limit for H bar going to zero. Another possible choice for A0 in large system is to take the so-called quasi-local observables, and these are highly non-commutative. Yes?
So I'm uneasy because for the computation case, the answer is zero. AX is non-commutative for every non-zero X.
Yeah.
But then you say it's a big blow. And of course, it has to be commutative for A0.
Yeah.
And this is making me worry about the statement that this is a continuous.
Yeah, I'll come to this. This is the whole point, that you can nonetheless define a continuous fiber bundle using a non-commutative and a commutative bundle. But this is almost unbelievable. It's an excellent question. It's highly unexpected from the intuition you have on vector bundles that there is this possibility, but it works. And I'll show this. The point of the talk is not so much quantization theory, but I'll include an example that basically makes the point. So if you hold on, I think I'll answer your question in a few minutes. Yes.
The reason does not actually include zero is an accumulation point which is not included in R.
No, but in this theory it is.
Oh, it is. You are including it.
Yeah, but that's what it says. Here, zeros in it.
Oh, continuous.
These are not typos. I mean, it's in fact essential for this picture that the boundary of this family of theories is part of the family. So the classical physics is part of this bundle. Right, so in quantization, the zero fiber is always commutative. Although, I mean, in mathematics, there is a trend where you actually quantize non-commutative algebras. Some meaning that you could also capture in this way. But in the context of physics or mathematical physics, A0 is commutative. But for large systems, there are two possibilities that are offered. Right. Now, as you know from vector bundle theory, the essential point is to define a topology on the bundle. And in a vector bundle, you can do this in two different ways. You can either do it directly, so you have this fiber bundle and you say what its topology is, or you can say what the continuous sections are. And these procedures are equivalent, because the Sternet-Swan theorem actually explains that these procedures are equivalent. Now, for a bundle of C star algebras, it's not so easy to describe the topology directly, although it's possible that it leads to very lengthy lists of axioms and properties. It's much, much easier to describe what the continuous sections are, and then indirectly, you have given the topology on the bundle. And so part of the definition of the bundle is not just specifying this family, but in addition saying simply, as part of the definition of the bundle, what the continuous sections are. So a section is a map called sigma, like in bundle theory, that associates an element of A of X, called sigma, to a given point X in the base space. And so the idea of continuity is captured by the fact that you cannot just say that everything is continuous. There are certain rules that limit what you can mean by continuity. And you can describe these rules very quickly in the way I did. So one rule is that the function from the interval to R plus given by mapping X, so again, X is either H bar or 1 over N or 0. So X is mapped into the norm of sigma of X, so where sigma of X is an element of fiber algebra sitting over X. But that has to be continuous functions. And that's not enough. There's a more technical requirement that if you take all sections together, they have to form a C-star algebra that is what's called a C0 over I module. And that means that basically they have to be enough. This will take many slides to explain, but the idea of continuity is captured already largely, I think, by this first axiom of continuity of the set. Now, and the upshot of this, everything is done in terms of the norm. You can study the transition from the quantum theory or from the large system to the classical theory or to the infinite system by norm continuity. And so basically repeating a point. So if you take a parameter space to consist of h bar, then this is the usual classical limit. And if you take the parameter system as appropriate for a large system, this is the limit of an infinite system. So and my view here is that what you basically do in h bar to zero is you approximate a classical a quantum system by a classical one. In the theory of infinite systems, you actually approximate a finite system by an infinite one. And approximation has to be controlled. And the advantage of this formalism, apart from its sort of visual beauty, that it at least has to mean, is that this approximation is controlled in the normal topology. So it's a very good control that you have. But so one comment about the classical limit of quantum mechanics is that the classical world is certainly an approximation. This is the point overlooked by the late John Bell, I think, who derided all attempts to explain the classical world that he called fact for all practical purposes. But the classical world in itself is fact. I mean, it is an approximate concept. It's not there in real life or in the universe. It's an approximation. And the point of classical physics is to provide an approximation to the quantum world in the semi-classical regime. And similarly about infinite systems. There are no infinite systems, you could argue. But an infinite system is an approximation to a very large system. And you have to control the approximation, and this is the point of the mathematics. Right. Now, I'll give one example of quantization theory in this language that should answer your question, which is the case we're all familiar with, apart from the moving of Rn. In fact, the older people may want to read R3, the younger people will appreciate the generality of working Rn. The classical algebra of observables consists of continuous functions on the phase space, R2n, that go to zero at infinity. That's what this zero means. This zero has nothing to do with that zero. Maybe this is for notation. So this is h bar zero. This means going to infinity. This, unfortunately, is traditional notation in operator algebra theory, that you describe a function going to infinity, going to zero at infinity by zero rather than infinity. Well, anyway. The quantum algebra of observables, in this case, consists of the compact operators from Schrödinger's Hilbert space, L2Rn. And typically, this is the same for all non-zero values of h bar. If you quantize a compact phase space, you typically get different quantum algebras for different values of h bar. But in the non-compact case, that is rare, although even there are some examples where that happens, but not in that space. So the quantum algebra of observables is the same for any value of h bar different from zero. And this is glued to one single fiber that is commutative. And that consists of this algebra of classical observables. Now, so I said that in order to define a continuity structure, you have to say what the continuous sections are. And these are defined by any decent quantization prescription, like Bayesian Toeplitz quantization. Like wild quantization is not indecent, but it's not suitable here because it lacks continuity properties. But this Bayesian quantization prescription, before I say how I use it, I'll remind you what it is. So you have a function f, a classical observable function on classical phase space. You have a parameter h bar different from zero, and qh bar of f will be a compact operator. So it will be an element of this h bar. These are coherent states that in fact depend on h bar. These are the well-known Schrödinger coherent states, you know, e to the minus x minus q squared over h bar, etc. And so they should have an additional label of h bar, but I didn't see how to put that in a nice way. H bar also explicitly occurs here. here in a somewhat singular way. And it turns out that this polarization construction, if you require for each f that this is a section, so you have to understand that the argument is not f but h bar. This is done for a fixed f, fixed classical observable. And for a fixed classical observable, you get a cross section of the bundle in which the base space point h bar is mapped into this operator. And in fact, for h bar of 0, I didn't write it down, but for h bar of 0, this very section maps f into itself. So it maps h bar into f. And then this turns out to satisfy all the rules of a continuous field. And any example of polarization that I'm familiar with, including extravagant things like the non-commutative torus, can be captured into this language. And so, as your question suggested, it's hard to glue a non-commutative to a commutative algebra. And you need some pretty singular expressions to accomplish it. But if you see, if you work this out, then this is exactly right. And once you have this, once you know that you have a continuous field, you get one property for free. So what I call asymptotic commutativity is not an axiom, but it's a property once you have a continuous field. Namely that for h bar going to 0, the quantization of f commutes with the quantization of g for a small h bar controlled by the norm. There's a much stronger property that doesn't follow from the definition of a continuous field, but happens to be satisfied in quantization theory, which is that even if you divide this by a bar and take the commutator, you still have convergence of something, but this something is the Poisson bracket. So this you can check in examples of quantization theory. It's not part of the axioms of a continuous field, but in physically relevant continuous field, this happens to be the case. And this is what Dirac always said. The commutator converges to the Poisson bracket, and this is a technical version of that specification. And using this, in many cases, you can derive theorems to the effect that quantum dynamics converges to classical dynamics. So this is a rule that's fundamentally related to the convergence of dynamics. And this is about the observables themselves. So this is how classical fields, how continuous fields occur in quantization theory. And for those who want more examples, I wrote a whole book about this. But in fact, before I forget this, I've taken back to on the plane to Holland this afternoon. I already gave out various reprints of a very large survey I wrote for the entire field, of which I have some left. So by all means, don't leave them here. Take one. Right, so that is the deformation quantization. I came to like it more and more. So even examples that you wouldn't expect fall into this regime or fall into this framework. Okay, so I'll repeat what I think is the important point. You approximate the quantum system by a classical system, and its approximation is controlled by the norm in this case. And now you could do the same for a large system. It's exactly the same game, but with different labeling of things, so to speak. So you suppose you have n copies of a given physical system, which you might think of simply as a qubit. So the whole richness of this approach is already clear in the simplest non-commutative example, where this C star algebra B is just the 2x2 matrices. But you can take almost anything. I assume for technical reasons that B has a unit, but that's basically the only restriction. So even if you're uncomfortable or you're unfamiliar with C star algebras, then you can think of the 2x2 matrices and you get enough mileage out of this. And the fact that you have n copies, you can actually interpret in various different ways. So traditionally, you can really think of a large system. So you have n particles, and you study its behavior for large n. But in the derivation of the Born rule and of Kolmogorov complexity, the application will actually be to repeated measurements. So you could take a single sample and prepare it in the same state or even in a different state every time, and that falls under the same mathematical heading. So a large system could be a repetition of a single small system, if you like. The mathematics is the same, basically. Now, there are two kinds of limiting observables for large n that are relevant to this game. So one are the quasi-local observables. And these are limits of local observables, and a local observable is one. Such that for every n, there is a fixed observable bn in the tensor product of n copies of b with itself, and the rest are ones. So if here you think about a large system with many particles at the same time, this means that you only study the system locally near you. You only study n particles that are around you, and the tail you do not look at. That's basically what this observable one denotes.
The idea is that m does not scale with n.
Now, and in the definition of a local observable, n is fixed. So you have to think of this, I'll get into this in detail, but you have to think of this as a sequence where n is a variable. And that a sequence where n is running is local when for fixed n, independent of n, it tends to be. Well, then there's a second class of observables, and these are quite different. They're macroscopic. They have these ones as well. So an observable is macroscopic if it's the limits of what I call average, and this average also has to be of the form where n varies, that there is a fixed n and a fixed n particle observable bn, and you add ones, but the difference is that you symmetrize. So you sum over all the permutations and you divide by one for n. And the best example, or the simplest example of an average, is precisely the average you will have in mind. Where you take a single site, a single particle observable B1, and you average it over all sites and divide it back. So observable that for large n you can approximate by such averages I call macroscopic. This is different from your paper, in fact, because you have n, you don't have. And the upshot is that macroscopic observables commute, or asymptotically commute, in the sense that if you take one such sequence and another, then in the limit the commutator vanishes in norm. The limits are all in norm. And they don't even only commute among each other, macroscopic observables, they also commute with the quasi-local observables. So in the, let's say, the old approach about formal algebras and so on, they will say that the macroscopic observables are in the center. So they commute with each other and with the,
Didn't interrupt you there, but in the previous, I just want to see if I understand this. In the previous discussion, the previous slide, it appeared that in these algebras, the way that this was continuous was that in any A sub H bar, there are extremely non-commuting observables.
Yes.
But if I start on at a particular value of H bar with two non-commuting observables and follow the trajectory down to A0, I find that they become less and less.
Yes, this is spot on.
Okay. Exactly. Is the same thing happening?
Yeah, I'll explain that. Okay. Yes. Right. Now, so with these two fundamentally different observables for large systems, you have two different associated continuous fields. They're both bubbles over the same parameter space that are already introduced, where you have the parameter space is zero. So zero is to be thought of as one over infinity. So the point zero describes the infinite system, or the infinite chain of measurements. And it's glued to the sequence one over n. And now, interestingly, the fibers above the non-zero point are the same for both fields. Namely, they're n copies of the given system, the tensor product of B. So if you're worried about tensor products, then this is the projective tensor product. Now, one field I call Q, AQ, for Q is both quantum and quasi-local. And the zero fiber of this AQ field is what is called the inductive limit. I don't want to give a definition here, but in a way it's B to the tensor power infinity, but in a better way than in theories of infinite tensor products of Hilbert space. This is a very decent type of C-star algebra that has been studied in enormous detail in the literature. And an essential point is this contains all the Bn's. So in particular, it contains the full non-commutativity of B and its nth tensor power. So you could say that this simply combines all the B to the tensor n in one big thing. The other one that I call C, where C stands for both classical and commutative, I think that this was an observation by Dirac, that the words classical and commutative both start with C. And also this C for continuous, I mean that's That's an accident, really. Mm-hmm. So this A0, classically, it consists of the continuous functions on the state space. Maybe I should write this down. It's not that one I use this notation. But S of B, state space of B. So in the case that B is the 2 by 2 matrices, the state space is the... Yeah, B, this B is for B, the one I use, and this B3 is the 3 ball. So you know that this is well, whose boundary is the Bloch sphere. You could call this the Bloch ball. It's the 3 ball of unit size in R3. So that's what I mean by S of B. And so the limiting algebra for a large system, if you look at the macroscopic observables, is the commutative C-structure of continuous functions on the state space. So I assume B is unital, has a unit, so it's a compact space. Now, when do you say, so as I said, in defining a continuous field, it's not enough to say what the fire is, right? You have to say what the continuity is, or the topology. And you do that by specifying the continuous sections. And in this case, in the Q case, the quantum or quasi-local case, the continuous sections are sequences, AN, that approximate a local sequence. And a local sequence is what I gave, one that has ones in the tail. And so if you have a given sequence, AN, such that it's arbitrarily well approximated by a given local sequence, you call the sequence quasi-local, and it defines a section of this quasi-local field whose limit A0 is simply the limit in the sense of inductive limit. So if you have such a sequence, it turns out that you can write down the limit as an element of this B infinity. And so the limiting element does not necessarily only have ones in the tail. The limiting elements may have sort of a small tail as long as it goes 0 to infinity. You do something very similar in quantum field theory. Now, the classical algebra is more subtle, and that's because you actually glue commutative algebra to a family of non-commutative ones. And this is done in the following way. So you first say that for finite n, a sequence is a continuous section of the field if it's arbitrarily well approximated by an average, say this single size operator average over n sides. And then the limiting element, A0, is a function. So as I said, in the classical case, the limiting algebra is a function algebra. So you can think of S of B as a classical phase series here. And the function A0 has to be assigned a value in the point omega. So omega is the state of B. And that value is the limit over n to infinity of omega to the tensor n on the sequence an. So the limiting value is uniquely defined by the sequence. And for example, and this example says it all basically, if an is not merely quasi-local, sorry, is an approximate average, but is precisely an average, so in this definition you only have to be well approximated by an average, but the special case is that you take a sharp average, this one, if you take the exact average of a one particle operator, then the limiting function is simply what you can call the Gelfand transform of B1. So B1 is an element of B. Omega is a state on B, and you get the function A0, whose value in the state omega is the value of the state at the operator B1. So you can easily actually compute these limiting elements. And as it turns out, and that's a lot of work in this case, you get a continuous field in this way. So you can check all the accidents.
What state do you choose? How do you choose them?
You don't have to choose it. I only have to say what the limiting function is. So I say, given such a sequence, if it satisfies this property, I say there is a limiting value, A0. This limiting value is a function on the state space. And I say what its value is in a given state. And that gives me the function.
So for all of
them? For any omega as a state of B. Right. Now, the first application is what you would call a derivation of the Born rule. Maybe if there's time for discussion, we can actually discuss whether this is a derivation. But it certainly corrects mathematical difficulties in other derivations. So let's stick to the example B, the 2 by 2 matrices. And for this B1, so I I use this this example of a macroscopic operator. So B1 is a single site operator, and since we are in quantum information theory building, use this qubit notation. We can write this as a 2x2 matrix. This is 0, 1, 0, 0 in that case. And then this average of the previous slide is what's called the frequency operator that you usually do not regard abstractly, but as defined on the Hilbert series. So it's defined on this the n-fold tensor product of one qubit. And these eigenstates are the eigenstates of the third Pauli matrix, if you like. So these are tensor products of single spin up or spin down states in the z direction, but instead of spin up and down, you write 0 at the bottom of this building. And so the eigenvalues simply count the number of occurrences of one such a sequence divided by n. And that's called the frequency operator. And this has been studied from the earliest attempts of deriving the Born rule. And what we now see is that this almost trivially defines a continuous section of the classical field, whose limiting value is a function which you can compute explicitly, and the value of this function, so the limiting value of this frequency operator for n is infinity. It's awkward that I have to call this f0, just because 1 over n is 0. You could call it f infinity if you like, as long as you don't see it as an operator, but as a function on the state space. And if you take a pure state psi, so from the Bloch sphere point of view, if you take a point on the boundary of the Bloch sphere, of the Bloch ball, then you get a pure state. And the value of this limiting function in this pure state psi, you can compute, and it's precisely the inner product of the Brouwer or Kett, I used this language a long time ago, of the state psi, the qubit psi, with 1 squared. So it's the Born probability for finding the outcome 1 of a measurement in state psi. And as I said, you will enter long discussions about the foundations of probability theory. But if you agree, and this is the controversial point, if you agree that you can define probabilities by infinite frequencies or by frequencies in infinite samples, then this is the derivation of the Born rule. However, it has been pointed out that this is not the right definition of probability. It leads to all sorts of problems. But granted the classical view of probability theory, this is the derivation of the Born rule, that avoids all the mathematical difficulties that you had in earlier derivations. Although this is in the same spirit, these earlier derivation parts of it. Okay, so that's the Born rule. Let's see. These continuous fields, I'll go through this one relatively quickly. So as I showed on the transparency on quantization theory, in examples of physically oriented quantization, you have more than a continuous field. You also have this rule that the commutator scaled by 1 over h bar converges to a Poisson bracket on the classical algebra. And you have that even here. But this was one of the things that Wagner Werner discovered. You can define a Poisson bracket on this limiting algebra for any Unital C-star algebra B. The Poisson bracket is basically the commutator. And then you have, I will not explain this in detail, you have the same structure, the same type of convergence of the commutator over h bar to the Poisson bracket, where now 1 over h bar is replaced by n. So you have to scale the commutator with the number of particles, and then you get convergence in norm of dynamics. And so I'd say that all, and this is a comment also Wagner Werner made, all the earlier work by both Newmont and Haag, all this work on superfluidity and superconductivity can be captured in this single result, that there is a convergence of the quantum dynamics given by the n particle Hamiltonians to a classical dynamics that governs what you see in that. So the single transparency sort of encompasses microscopic effects in solid state physics in a very neat way. So that's a bonus that you get. Another interesting thing is what I would call quantum definiti. The so-called quantum definiti theory has been, I think, rediscovered in quantum information theory by a number of people. Because in operator algebras, the underlying result was well known. It was due to Michael Sturmer. And in this context, it amounts to the following observation. You can make quasi-local and macroscopic observables talk to each other. So as I said, you have two quite different limiting observables. One is, gives rise to a classical algebra, the other to a very non-commutative algebra. But they still communicate. And in this language, you do this through what I call a global field of states. So a global field of states is a family of states on each n-fold tensor product of the single site algebra B, which has a limit both in one field and in the other field. So not all states have this property, but you can imagine families of states for finite n that have limits both to this commutative limiting algebra of macroscopic observables and to the non-commutative algebra of quasi-local observables. And examples of this are exchangeable states, as the Finetti or Bayes in the literature would call them. So these you get by starting from the state on the inductive limit. So this is, again, this algebra was basically infinitely many copies of B. Now, a state on this infinite tensor product of B is called exchangeable if its restriction to any finite B to the power n is permutation invariant. If you do that, you actually get, so if you start with a limiting, if you start with the limit state, so you start with the state on the quasi-local observables that has this permutation invariance property, then you can restrict it to each b to the tensor power n. And then it turns out that you get a global field of states. If you do this for every n, you satisfy this criterion. You satisfy it on the quantum quasi-local algebra by construction. But these exchangeable states also turn out to have a limit to the microscopic observables. This observation has been made by many also by David. And if you then use Stirmer's theorem, which in quantum information theory is called the quantum De Finetti theorem. So De Finetti may not even be known to us, but he's one of the heroes of subjective probability theory. Basically, have two heroes, Bayes and De Finetti. So they like to use this word, but I would call it Stirmer's theorem. And Stirmer's theorem characterizes the limiting state on the classical algebra. So Stirmer's theorem itself says that this limiting state, that is the starting point of the construction, so a given exchangeable state on the inductive limit of n copies of B, is actually an integral over states rho to the tensor power infinity. This is a highly non-trivial result, that for commutative B is due to the Finetti, for non-commutative B is due to Stirmer. And it's this very same measure that yields the classical limit of this family of states. So this omega zero q is the limit of this family to the quasi-local observables. This contains a measure, and this measure is precisely the limit state of macroscopic observables. So as I said, the macroscopic observables form a function algebra of continuous functions on the state space of B. And so a state on this function algebra is a measure on the state space of B. And this measure is precisely what you get in the decomposition of an exchangeable state, according to the Finetti intervention. So this situation is really extremely neat. Now, I'll stop in 5 minutes. I'll say a few words about randomness in quantum mechanics. So as I said, on my way of completing what I feel to be the Copenhagen interpretation, there should be some comment on the intrinsic randomness of measurement outcomes. And as you know, randomness in classical physics is always caused by either uncertainty in the initial state, this was the point of view of Frank Array, or by time averaging, this was the point of view of Boltzmann and Einstein. In fact, these are related by ergodic theory. But randomness in quantum physics is believed to be irreducible or intrinsic. Although if you believe Heisenberg, it's not quite irreducible, because ultimately randomness is an outcome of our choice of looking at the classical context or classical strength. If you don't do that, there is no probability in quantum physics. But if you agree that we look at a given classical setting for quantum physics, we have randomness of measurement outcomes, and that randomness, given the classical context, is believed to be fundamental or intrinsic or irreducible, whatever you call it. So this, you could say, was one of the themes of the Bohr-Einstein debate. And And to some extent, this was settled by the work of Bell. So you could argue, the argument is not quite right, but you could argue that the violation of the Bell inequalities, whether it actually happens in the lab or not, suppose it does, actually is a proof of randomness of quantum mechanics. But as you know, there is this issue of locality in the whole argument of Bell that sort of clouds the issue. So there are always the Bohmians who will maintain that quantum mechanics is a deterministic theory. And within the context of Bell-type arguments, they have a valid point. So I would say you should look in another direction for a proof of fundamental randomness of quantum mechanics. And this you could do, for example, there may be other possibilities, but this you could do by asking the question whether a sequence of measurement outcomes is random in some sense. In what sense, I'll discuss very briefly. But that's the nature of the question. So if Bohr was right and Einstein was wrong, a sequence of measurement results should be random in a suitable sense. And so you have to ask what a good definition of randomness is. And well, there are whole books about this issue. My question will be restricted to this single example. So I take spin z, spin one half particle, measure spin z in this superposition. I identify spin up with 1, spin down with 0. I measure over and over again, and I ask, is this sequence random or not, and if so, in what sense? Now, it's actually very hard to define randomness, and it took until the 60s, until the definition was found, that you can use. A related question that a mathematician would ask, and this is a question of quantum physicists about randomness, but mathematicians asked from the beginning whether pi is a random sequence. And you could either say yes or you could say no. If you measure the statistics of the digits of pi, then all possible randomness tests are satisfied. So the numbers of what, so the number 1 occurs about 10% of the time. Every conceivable combination of natural numbers occurs with the frequency that you expect statistically based on randomness and so on. And yet pi is not random because it's determinant that you can give. As a likeness and such people that you need a series expansion, you can define it in terms of a circle. Pi is a determinate number, it's not a random number, but it still looks very random. So the point of complexity theory was to distinguish the case where a number actually looks random, but is in fact determined, from the case where the number is really random. And that's exactly, yeah?
Just, you do mean all known statistical tests, not all possible.
No, there is a theory of all possible statistical tests.
Is pi known to be normal?
No. Well, but that might still be a conjecture, in fact. I'm not sure that the example of pi...
I think it's not known.
Well, I'm not... This will Google up. Well, but there is overwhelming evidence and belief that pi is wrong. Okay, so it's not essential for the rest of the talk. A related question, which really caught me, is if you do a coin tossing, then a series of zeros, so my son is a very shrewd coin tosser, and he always wins, and he could easily produce the sequence. On the other hand, if you play with an honest person, you would expect a sequence like this. And then you can ask, what's wrong with this one? Because I have precisely the same probability, namely 2 to the minus n. So why do you feel cold with this sequence, and do you feel comfortable if this is the outcome sequence, because both have the same probability. And yet we have the feeling that this one is random, and this one is fraudulent or undetermined. Now, so Hilbert, I would say that this goes back to this discussion of Hilbert's sixth problem in his famous list in 1900. So one of them was the axiomatization of probability theory, including a definition of randomness. And this was picked up early on, especially by Borel and later on by von Mises. And there seems agreement, this is not my field, but I'd be happy to learn more about it. There seems general agreement that the definition of randomness has been found by Michael Gorov for finite sequences and a megalomaniac guy called Chaitin, very interesting, for infinite sequences. So Chaitin writes one book after the other, as you may know, in which he claims he's the successor to Gödel and Turing. But this definition of randomness was correct. So the idea of Kolmogorov was to base the definition of randomness on, well, either computability or compressibility. And the fundamental point is that a number is random if it is its own shortest description. So if it's incompressible in a lossless way. And so technically there's a whole story about universal Turing machines and you basically get to the idea that the complexity of a string, so x is a string, f1 is 2, which in this definition is finite, like zeros or ones. And so the complexity of a string is basically the length of the shortest computer program that produces it, or is able to print it. And this turns out to be independent of the computer that you actually use, up to a constant. And you could say that the finite sequence is random if its complexity is the same or bigger than its size. And the more you think about all the examples, this is really a good definition. And then an infinite sequence, so to find the definition of randomness of an infinite sequence was very difficult, and that's one of the problems solved by Chaitin. You can't say that an infinite sequence is random if all its finite segments are random. That turns out to be no random sequences. But this is the correct definition. It's an asymptotic, it's a limiting condition. And when I see a limit, I think of continuous fields of C-star algebras. So I'll relate that to my program. But one theorem of this complexity theory definition is that if the number is random in this algorithmic sense, it actually satisfies all statistical tests for randomness. There is a catch that may actually defeat the entire program, but you can show that that's a theorem of Chaitin that most random numbers cannot be proved to be random. So by abstract arguments, you can, for example, prove that the overwhelming majority of numbers between 0 and 1 in their binary expansions are random. But if you take a given one, you cannot solve the halting problem. So you cannot actually prove it's random. Although to higher beings, it is known that they are random. But you can prove it of some numbers, and that's enough for quantum physics. So I should say that this is not finished. I mean, I'm still working on the precise limiting arguments, and so don't quote me on that, but it looks like going in the right direction. You can actually prove randomness of the measurement outcomes using the formalism that I advertised. And this is based on an idea, so there's an unpublished, maybe it's not even a paper, maybe other people know, there's an unpublished work, it may just be a discussion. Quoted as due to Coltman and Lesniewski. Lesniewski I knew, he was a mathematical physicist, but he went to work for a bank later on. And Coltman is the famous Sidney Coltman. And so they had an idea that was made fairly rigorous by Sam Goodman, but I think the proof of Goodman is still fishy. And the idea is that you take a projection, so you take m copies of the one qubit Hilbert space, C2, and this projection projects onto the linear span of all n-fold tensor products for which the associated string is random in the given sense. And then you hope, and so Goodman proved it in a certain sense, you can hope that if you do this for n is infinity, that the repetition of a single state psi, so the infinite tensor product of the single state that I gave, so the spin up and spun down with equal weight states, that this is an eigenstate. So for any finite n, this will not be the case. So for any finite n, these are the eigenstates. And superpositions like this, repeated over and over, will not be eigenstates of Pn for any finite n. And so the hope was that if you take the limit n to infinity, in fact, the infinite tensor product does become an eigenstate, with eigenvalue 1 in this case. And if you regard the projection operator as a yes and no question in the sense of von Neumann, eigenvalue 1 means answer yes, and so that will prove that this the sequence is of associated measurement outcomes is random. And so they had difficulty with infinite tensor products, I think, as a proof. And the technical execution in the framework of C-star algebras is easier. So you have to show that the sequence of projections defined in this way is a continuous section in my classical field. So that was the one based on microscopic observables with the commutative limiting algebra, with a limiting function. And this limiting function evaluated at the pure state psi, not at other pure states, but at this particular pure state psi, where you expect a random outcome. The value of the limiting function at psi is equal to 1. So as I said, I haven't finished this, but it looks like it's going in the right direction. And this is then very, very similar to the derivation of the Born rule. And the interpretation will be that the limiting function is classical, meaning it sits inside the classical algebra, it's has a dispersion-free value 1, and the meaning of this value 1, it inherits from the finite PNs, namely the given string is random. And so that's my envisaged proof of randomness. That's not finished, but I think it's right in this way. And it's very similar to the proof of the Born rule, and it's also the same for people who worked on the proof of the Born rule and the proof of randomness. Okay, there are many things against this program, but I think mathematically this solves the major problems. Now, what's my conclusion? So I think that the main point is that in a large system, it is essential to control the approximation of the finite system by an infinite one. So first, there's the point of view that an infinite system is an approximation to a finite one, and then you have the issue of controlling how good the approximation is. And this can be done very well using this language of continuous fields, I think. And to repeat, large systems have two types of interesting limiting observables, the quasi-local ones, which are very non-commutative and are based on the idea of local measurements, and the classical or macroscopic ones, which are commutative and which are based on averaging. And that's the type of behavior called for by the Copenhagen interpretation. So if you take the idea seriously that an experimental apparatus is large compared to the system it is supposed to measure, then this is a relevant context. But as I said, Born and Heisenberg, I think, did not really foresee the difficulties in realizing this possibility of a classical description. But this is about how it should go. And the formalism can be applied to repeated measurements in the cloud system, and then you get both the proof of the Born rule and of randomness. So this is what I have to offer you. Thank you. And that's you don't have one.
Okay, let me throw up my question. Could you go back to the first phase of Schubert where you considered the stage bar goes to zero living?
Let's see, this is a long time ago.
It was way
this one.
Yes, it's a beautiful example. How you here would describe, if I consider functions which are not in your class, for instance, I would get the phase space effects, which would constitute, for instance, Ansoff position, Ansoff momentum by Spitzkes. Could you somehow describe what would be the classical approximation?
Well, I think if you go outside this algebra, then you can enlarge. This is the easiest continuous field. If you take bounded functions, instead of functions going to infinity, zero at infinity, and don't take compact operators, but the pseudo-differential operators, you get more. And in this you can, that's where you stop having control over the norm topology. Otherwise, you would have to use the language of distribution theory, and you would lose the framework. So there is a certain tension between this approach and the use of physically relevant observables that tend to be unbounded. You have this tension also in algebraic quantum field theory, and there I learned not to worry about it simply. I mean, you can have very good mathematical results if you use bounded or compact operators. Then, of course, in the laboratory you measure unbounded observables, and this framework is unsuitable for that. And that is a pity. So it is somewhat idealized.
So we need two different classical limits, h bar is 0 and n goes to infinity. Which is the right one?
Now, I say there are, like if you have a war, there are many causes for war. There isn't usually one. So there are many ways that the classical regime can occur. So one way is for single particle systems. If the regime is such that effectively h bar is very small, another is a large system, and there may be yet other instances of classical behavior that I am not familiar with. But there isn't only one theory of the classical limit, I think. There are just various situations where this happens. But mathematically, if you identify 1 over n with h bar, they're analogous, large systems and small particles. But a small particle can behave classically. You don't need, and also this was not sufficiently stressed or even denied by Bohr, this possibility that you could have classical behavior in single systems is not something he really advertised. It's quite against his philosophy even, but that's clearly the case, you can see it. So there are many examples, and what the right notion of classicality in quantum cosmology is, I think, remains to be discovered. It is neither of the two that I discussed. That's a joke for the Perimeter Institute.
On the modern rule, you saw these beautiful results. Probably I have forgotten something, but in a book on quantum measurement theory, we also followed Finkelstein and Butler to give a kinder derivation. Of course, you give much more rigorous. But so far, as I remember, this rule somehow depends on solving the measurement problem. That we can.
Well, but that's, I think, that is denied by this type of approach. Yeah. For every finite, and you would have a measurement problem, but in the limit. I should, in fact, read your discussion, which I haven't. Also, this has been written up with Born rule and complexity arguments. But in which of your various books is it?
Quantum measurement.
Yeah. It's in the quantum measurement, the weakness of stats.
Yeah, can I follow up on that question before I
So I would say that it's, in fact, you, the strength of this approach is that you do not have to solve the measurement problem, but this may be wrong, maybe a wrong interpretation of the math.
Well, have you considered the interaction of a quantum particle with a classical measurement device? How to...
This is predicated on the fact that you only look at macroscopic observables. So if your world, which is the laboratory world, only is sensitive to the macroscopic observables, which are classical, I think the result is right. However, if you mix it up with the microsystem that you started with, then you may have to solve the measurement problem, and the result may be wrong. But the fact that you get a dispersion-free limit function is because you only limit your attention to microscopic observables, and that's probably not what you do in your book. So this is based on this extremely strong assumption that that is what you do. And then you get a functional commutative algebra and you get a sharp value instrument.
So Lucien's question about which of these is the right approach and your answer points out that both of these can be unified, or it seems like they can, by thinking about action ratios. Obviously, h bar goes to zero is equivalent to saying that there's some other action in your problem relative to which h bar is very small.
What do you mean by an action? Yeah, I've never understood this phraseology of the quantum of action and so on that Bohr uses. Well, what do you mean by an action?
H bar has units of.
Because it seems next to me. Shugefer has been having stress as far as.
Precisely speaking, if h bar is a constant, right?
Yeah.
So the statement h bar goes to zero has to mean that there is some other quantity in your formulation,
yeah, of course,
which has the same units, which is much larger.
Yeah.
And in the same way, if I have many copies, if n goes to infinity, then provided that each system of which I have a copy has more than one state, which is a pretty simple assumption, then the total action or total phase space volume accessible to that system will also increase. So it seems as if one, you might be able to, maybe you don't want to, maybe you can, but you might be able to unify these two things, these two approaches in this way. But, so here's my actual question. In order to do that, that raises a question of the speed of convergence. If you have a single system and you let h bar go to zero, you let the total action of the system go to infinity, then the sort of the radius of the accessible phase space increases linearly with h bar.
Yes.
But if you increase the number of systems, then the radius of the accessible phase space, this accessible phase space is very high dimensional, and the radius actually goes logarithmically with h bar.
Mm-hmm.
And so what I'm curious is, do you have any way of quantitatively analyzing the convergence to classicality in your two limits?
No, not yet, but it's a very interesting question. And I think the framework is suitable for that. I should understand the logarithm that you mentioned. So, no, I have thought about that, but it would be a good part of the problem.
So sorts of situations where quantum theory are interesting display both quantum and classical theories. For example, Stone-Gard, which is any measurement you have the quantum particle, then you have the classical measuring apparatus. Do either of these sort of approaches work for that in a situation where you can explain partial classicality of the measuring apparatus whilst leaving the other degrees of freedom quantum?
It's a very sensible question, but this is not the right framework. I think this is not intended to understand such regimes. I mean, you could, of course, take the tensor product of, there's a notion of a tensor product of two continuous fields, and you could do that. So one would be the apparatus described as a large system. The other could be the measured system that remains small. And the zero fiber would no longer be commutative. It would be the tensor product of, say, the 2x2 matrices and this classical function algebra. It could be phrased in the same language, but it hasn't been intended for that. And I don't see what you gain using this machinery against normal methods, so to speak. I mean, the idea is really that you study convergence to a commutative algebra in this language. Although mathematically it's more general, but that's the whole goal. And also the problem I put was to identify classical regimes and describe them mathematically. What you ask is more subtle, but this is not one of my goals.
Yeah, but you quoted the 72 cases going exactly that way. You said it doesn't fit into your opinions.
HEP is more in the direction of what you said, but I didn't quote it for that reason. I mean, I use all sorts of lemmas that are not part of this talk, but you find in this paper. And half of them are due to HEP. So I quote him technically, but it's visionary. Although he was, perhaps some of you have read this book by Lee Smoller called The Trouble with Physics. And so he identifies seers. The word visionaries was too difficult for the American audience, perhaps. He identifies seers and craftsmen. And one of the greatnesses of HEP was that he was a seer as well as a craftsman. But in this case, I cite him as a craftsman. As Bohr was only a seer. And Einstein was both. I mean, the really great people, also Newton, were seers and craftsmen. And at the lesson we also have, I think, wasn't that in mathematical physics, he had both aspects. But not for the purpose of this talk.
Good question. I enthusiastically agree with the characterization of infinite dimensional systems as approximations to finite dimensional systems. Infinite dimensional C-star algebras can have properties that are discontinuously different from finite dimensional. So my question is, are there any of these properties that are true for infinite dimensional C-star algebras, but never for finite dimensional, that are relevant directly to experimental physics?
No, that's a good point. This very question is the reason why I have always been worried about the theory of superselection rules, because it only exists in infinite systems, and any finite approximation to an infinite system, so it's the opposite type, doesn't have superselection rules. It's about uniqueness of irreducible representations. And now I share the worry. I'm not sure about the experimental practice, but this talk doesn't rely on that. And so, as I said, the point of this is precisely to have control of the limit, and there shouldn't be. Well, you could say that the fact that the non-commutativity disappears suddenly is a discontinuous jump. But if you look at the continuous sections of the appropriate fields, then everything is continuous. So, one of the goals of this approach is to avoid precisely these sort of jumps that only happen for infinite systems. Although, if you look carefully, they are there, but they're sort of suppressed by the use of continuous sections. And there should be more of that in the theory of superselection rules, I think, which, as I said, I feel very uncomfortable with for this reason. So, I share the sentiments at the beginning.
Can these limits be translated in terms of probabilities of seeing something that you're saying, like, if the system was really an infinite number of copies, then you would only see this, and this type of behavior.
Yeah.
What about probabilities in the case of finite system that you don't?
Yeah, this is a good point, and one of the critiques on the derivation of the Born rule of this style had been that, in fact, finite and this is a very bad approximation. That would be an instance where an infinite system is a very bad approximation to a finite system. So I was on guard for this possibility, but I didn't see it actually becoming effective. So these limits were as I gave. And you get the Born rule in this way. So I actually announced in my abstract that I was going to discuss the relationship between this approach and your paper on macroscopic observables. I failed to do it. And this is one of the issues, indeed. So your paper on macroscopic observables is a reward against this type of thinking.
But for instance, but there is a finite version of the definite theorem that perfectly controls all the errors.
Yeah, that's right. So on a more subtle approach.
It's probably possible, but you're not aware of any.
No, I didn't see the pitfalls in the way I perceived it. It works unexpectedly smoothly, indeed. But if you look at how things are actually done in the laboratory, you might see the pitfalls, but then you said you can solve them as well. So either you proceed sort of with blinded eyes and it's all smooth, or you actually are on guard, but then you know that by a better procedure you can solve the problems that arise. So I think that the outcome of this approach is right. But to actually implement it operationally, more work would have to be done. But you will reach the same conclusion, especially about the Born rule. So there's a good paper by David Poulin on macroscopic observables, complementary to this approach.
That might be a good note.
All right.